This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
This is Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, who is the producer of the show. So, Carrie, yes. It is primary week in Michigan, and it is way earlier this year than it normally would be. Michigan is kind of toward the front of the row of states that are helping to select the nominees for president and the Democratic and the Republican parties. And that's not an accident. There was a concerted effort for a long time to get this moved up so that we would matter more, so that the voices, the diverse voices in our state, would count in a way that they haven't in the past.
Yeah, I vividly remember in 2020, March of 2020, I'm sure many people remember March of 2020. I don't have to say why, but our primaries were held early in March. And I remember how whittled down the field had gotten by the time our primaries came. Like, wow, the candidates that ran in the Democratic primary aren't really there by the time Michigan had a time to vote for them. Now, this year is a different type of race. 2024, we've got an incumbent presidency, but still, the state is a bit earlier, before Super Tuesday, and this could have some implications going forward. So it'd be interesting to talk to some folks about what this means, why they wanted to do this, how this impacts the voters and our the amount of power we might have in the momentum of the race going forward.
Yeah, right. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell has been at the forefront of this fight to get Michigan moved up for a really long time. She's been in my ear about it for many years. And so we're going to talk to her today about how that came to be and how important it is that states like Michigan, which have more diverse populations than most of the other early states, you think of Iowa, you think of New Hampshire, those are not states whose populations really represent many other Americans. Michigan's different. Also, our manufacturing base, our agricultural base, those are things that should weigh in early in the race. And so they do now because of the work that she did. And lots of other people in Michigan as well, of course, were pushing for this.
And I don't know, unless you really focus deeply into politics, you're not thinking about the considerations that go into a decision like this.
That's
the fact that our industries and the diversification of our industries, the different types of industries might be more prevalent or more important during a race. I hadn't considered that. The fact that candidates didn't come to your state sooner, hadn't considered that. So it's good to get this information too, just to find out like how these races are run and why it is that we get so many candidates going to certain states and why these positions matter so much.
It'll be a really interesting conversation. And we're done with her. We're going to talk also with Jamal Simmons, who is a native Detroiter who was most recently Vice President Kamala Harris's chief communications officer. He's somebody who has been active in Democratic politics, worked on the Hill, worked on campaigns for a really long time. I want to get his take on this, too, from more of a national's perspective, really, about how the tickets come together, how support comes together for candidates and keeps them going early in the race.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be nice to get a national perspective from it. I mean, Debbie Dingell's been on the ground, so that's a really good voice to hear about the process and the campaigning, I should say, for this move. And then to hear Jamal Simmons talk about it as well, be helpful to get the understanding of the theory behind it and what it changes for the voters here.
Yeah. So let's get to Debbie Dingell and then we'll hear from Jamal Simmons. So Debbie, welcome to Created Equal.
Well, it's great to be here. Congratulations on the new show. And I can't wait to hear its new format, but I'll still be listening like I always am.
Right. Of course, you were one of the most frequent guests, in fact, on Detroit Today for the 9 years that I hosted it. We had many, many conversations. But this is actually a conversation that we didn't have much on Detroit Today, but it is something that you and I have talked about for a really long time. I can remember more than a decade ago, you talking about the importance of shaking up the primary system, changing the order of states, and including more people in the front end of the choices that we make in presidential years. So I want to go back to that time when you were one of not that many voices, really, who were out front saying, hey, this doesn't work. We need to do something different. Tell me why the system that we've had forever doesn't work, and tell me about the journey to try to get the party, your party in particular, the Democratic Party, to change that.
So I'm going to take you back further.
Even further. Okay.
Than that 10 years ago where we were almost successful, to Senator Carl Levin, who decades ago, in the late 80s, recognized that two small states, Iowa and New Hampshire, which are not diverse, which do not reflect the diversity of this country, were having a disparate impact upon who got nominated to be president. And I opposed Carl Levin twice because people don't understand how complicated the presidential nominating system is. As soon as this next presidential election year is over, the presidential nominating system, the rules of the game, are established by both parties, mm-hmm. Republican and Democrats, for the next cycle, which is one of the challenges for this year for Republicans in Michigan. But I told Carl Levin that he was right, that these two states should not have the disparate impact. You can't change the rules of the game in the middle of the game, but that I would work with him at the beginning of the next time.
Yeah.
So approximately a decade ago, we got close to the finish line.
Right.
And why does it matter? Because I don't think any one state should have a lock on going first. But you see what happens when you're an early state. You're already seeing it here in Michigan. You're seeing the candidates come to Michigan after Iowa's done, New Hampshire's done, South Carolina. Then Georgia was supposed to be in there. Mm-hmm. Michigan's next. And candidates are coming to Michigan.
And let's talk about why that matters. The disparate impact that you talk about. Look, there are a certain number of delegates available to every presidential candidate. The person who's going to get the most of those delegates is going to be the nominee. Why does the order in which you get those delegates and the order of the states that get to choose their delegates, why does it matter? Shouldn't it just be that, hey, if you're a good candidate, you'll get votes everywhere, and the best person will win? Why does that not a sufficient explanation for the way it works?
This is such a complicated subject, and most people don't understand how complicated it is. But I'm going to start with the point you made. Everybody knows about Iowa and New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And the presidential candidates, those people that are not running in 24 this year, but are likely candidates in both the Republican and Democratic Party, when Ron DeSantis dropped out, already started talking about 2028.
28, sure.
And Iowa and New Hampshire are states that they immediately focus on. They know every issue that any voter in Iowa or New Hampshire cares about, they study and they focus on. The media knows every corn dog and state fair and every in New Hampshire and Iowa. They live there and they write about those issues on a national basis. So we know the issues that matter in those two states. If you are somebody that's trying to make a difference, many of the candidates for president are already in elected office, or they're in a business, the issues that matter. Why do we have ethanol fuel? Iowa, corn.
Corn.
It's these two small states. Everybody focuses on them. Everybody goes to those two states. And the issues that matter there I think everybody should have the opportunity to have the issues that matter in that state be discussed and focused on. But I think two small states that do not reflect the diversity of this country should have that big an impact on who becomes president.
So is there also something about just momentum that takes hold in these primaries? In other words, if you win in Iowa and you win in New Hampshire, or if you lose in those states, it becomes easier or harder to continue your campaign, to get the attention on the issues that you are focused on, and more difficult for voters in other states to kind of push their issues into the race?
So it's more than momentum is one of the issues. You immediately see everybody say, if this candidate doesn't do well, they're going to have to drop out when they, but money is money. Unfortunately a
Which
very big part
momentum,
of this.
Right?
Money follows momentum. So candidates, if they're not viewed as having a chance, if they're not viewed as being in the mix, they don't get the money. And even candidates that are spending their own money, self-funding candidates, find themselves dropping out because they simply don't have the money to compete. If you've watched what President Trump's strategy has been, it's to try to cut off money to anybody that's running against him or to create it. So, I mean, to be perfectly candid, money matters in those early states.
Yeah. So let's talk about how we've gone about the process of changing all this. As I said, I believe it was the 2012 presidential contest where you and I were probably talking the most about this in advance of 2012. It may have been 2016.
It was actually 2008 because...
Was it 2008? Okay.
It was when President Obama was running against Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
And we were almost there. We were at the finish line, and I won't get into a lot of petty details, but somebody wrote something I've learned to read every word of a bill after that experience that a candidate could take their name off the ballot. So while Michigan was prepared to go first, President Obama took his name off the ballot in Michigan.
Right, right. I want to go back to that. That was such a dramatic event and moment. And for a while, there was a question about whether we would count at all, right, if we went ahead and did what we were talking about doing. And as you say, it wasn't according to the rules. And so that's why you had Obama react the way he did and other officials in the party.
Well, he didn't think he was going to win in Michigan in that early. I mean, we could have lots of discussions about this. And we did, by the way. What work Michigan did is what got two states added to it. South Carolina and Nevada were added because of the work that Carl Levin
did.
I mean, I got to say, I joined Carl Levin. Carl Levin took this fight on, and this presidential primary in Michigan in February, I tell everyone, is because Carl Levin cared about everybody in this country and thought every voice should be heard.
Yeah.
I was his partner. I carried it on after he passed and got it over the finish line with my friend, Senator Stabenow, the state party. But the other interesting thing about 2008 was that Saul Nosis was the Republican Party chair.
Yeah.
We did it together.
Right.
We knew that it was good for this state in a bipartisan way. Business knew. Everybody understood how important it was. And we were standing together in a bipartisan way, ready to just, okay, by the way, Michigan mattered. So you're going to tell us we don't count at a convention? Did you say you wanted to win Michigan in November? It required people with a backbone to push the process.
Yeah. And of course, now we have that change through the rules, right? Through the regular process.
So again, it's complicated. You have to have lived, eat, and breathe this for 30 years, which I admit that
which you
because
have.
Of Senator Levin, I have. The Republicans set their rules for the primary right immediately, and they did not have Michigan as one of the early states.
Yeah.
Now, a number of Republicans supported what happened, as did business and chambers, but Ronna Romney McDaniels, the chair of the National Republican Party, said you can't change the rules in the middle of the game. And we have, though. Republicans have set up a process. Our rules came later. Were set almost a year after the Republicans set their rules. And President Biden believed that, I mean, Iowa, nobody supported still going first because of the way that it so mismanaged and the chaotic results of their caucus. It's now 4 years.
Yeah.
But we were doing this. New Hampshire is not giving up its first in the place country. So they were not sanctioned by the rules of the DNC. President Biden was not on the ballot in New Hampshire. They still held an election. There was a write-in, and he won.
And he won.
So I'm sure that next, when we finish this presidential election and we start writing rules again, we'll have a lot of intense discussion about this again.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about the order of primary states in presidential years and what that means in terms of whose voice matters and when in presidential contest with Debbie Dingell, U.S. Representative for the 6th District here in Michigan. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET-FM in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. We're talking with Debbie Dingell, U.S. Representative for the 6th District of Michigan, about the significance of the primary order in presidential years. Iowa, New Hampshire, those are states that immediately come to mind when you think about presidential primaries because since 1972, for instance, Iowa has held the very first contest of the presidential sequence. That is something that a lot of people say is unfair to lots of voters in other states and also favors two states, Iowa and New Hampshire, that don't really represent the full diversity of the population here in the United States. We're talking about how that order has changed, why it has changed, and what difference it will make. Debbie, I want to talk a little more about how changing the order of states in which they vote in presidential years gives minority voters a stronger voice. And I'm just going to start with a few stats. Michigan, for instance, has a population that is 14.1% African-American and 5.7% Latino. By contrast, Iowa has a population that is only 4% African-American. New Hampshire, only 2%. A state like South Carolina, which has now moved up in the order, of course, is 26% African-American. So this shift, even if you take the view that demographically, in terms of population and size, favor states that have more people in them, they also favor this diversity that exists in some parts of the country in greater number, greater concentration than it does others. I want to have you talk about why that matters. Why is that important?
So, again, this is a complicated subject because I first want to say that every vote matters. So every person matters. But those two, New Hampshire and Iowa, do not reflect the population of this country. And what you want to do in a primary or caucus system is talk about the issues. They're going to be the issues that are going to be the ones that matter in the general election. So what and by the way, I don't think any one state should have a lock on going first. I think everybody's got the right to have candidates talk about their issues, to take the time to spend, to understand their issues, to have the national media focus on it. So I think that if we really have managed to shake this process up and discussions continue to how to make it fairer and more representative, maybe you down the road go to regional primaries so the candidates are in regions that may have similar issues, but that, you know, you're really talking about what the issues are. The reason that I have fought for Michigan to be one of the early states with others is that, one, Michigan is a purple state. Someday, everybody's going to believe me that Michigan's not a blue state. It's not red. Most people don't argue too much it's red, but this is not a blue state. Every election is close. We reflect the diversity of the country, but we make things and we grow things. We have, as you just said, we have a significant urban African-American population, Hispanic population, but we have significant We've got farming communities. We've got union communities. We have Arab American communities, Muslim communities, Indian communities. I'm now going to get in trouble because we have women and men. And there are a lot of communities that are really important. We have a lot of people of faith, but those faiths are all different religions. We have Baptists and Catholics and Christians and Hindus and atheists. And I'm not leaving anybody out here. I just don't want to. That's what's so good. But, you know, when people talk about New Hampshire or Iowa, they say, well, they get hands-on. They get to talk to voters directly. You know what? You can talk to voters directly here. We have a richness of festivals and farmers markets and places where people come together and talk about the issues that are just on their minds. On any given Saturday, I'm at 14 different events. And that's one of the reasons I have good gut and will tell you who I and what. You didn't think I was correct at the time, but I told you that Donald Trump was going to win Michigan because I go in those union halls.
In 2016.
In farmers markets. I don't know who's going to win. I think Michigan's a competitive state right now, just for the record. But you can talk to people. And we have all four seasons. We understand all the issues that come with seasons. We have 20% of the world's fresh water. There is all the issues, not all, because we have a border, but it doesn't have the same border issues that the South does. We should have states in there that are talking about the border issue because that matters so much. You need to make sure that those states that are having such a strong impact on who gets nominated are states where the issues that are going to matter in November are being talked about. People are expressing their opinion and they're voting how they feel. And what they're voting is going to determine who that candidate's going to be in November.
Yeah. And of course, if we look back at history here in Michigan, both on the Democratic and the Republican side, we've had a tendency to surprise a little bit, to do things that that national pundits or media might not predict, and to do things that don't necessarily follow the trend of the primaries that come before us. Okay, so I'm going to go back to 1988, of course, when Jesse Jackson was a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. He won the state of Michigan. It was one of the only states that he did win. I'm not sure if it was the only one, but it was certainly one of the only ones. And it was on the strength of the diversity of the party here in Michigan that he was able to do
that. George Wallace also.
George Wallace won the primary
also,
back
because
in 68,
I think,
right?
It's very important that when we have these discussions that we want to make sure everybody's included. Mm-hmm. So sometimes one of the things that's happening in this state is that a union worker doesn't feel like they matter. They do matter. Every person matters. We want the African-American voter in the city of Detroit or the city of Pontiac or Ypsilanti or Oakland County. They need to be heard. Their mm-hmm. issues matter. But so does the union worker. I'll tell you right now, we got to get in every union hall in this state right now because union voters are worried about their future, what's going to happen to their job. You know, we say we're bringing them home. Are we really bringing them home? We need to worry about urban issues. We've had a great year. We're seeing, I mean, everybody knows Detroit's got grit, but there's still a lot of urban issues that are facing not only us in Michigan, but a lot of cities around the country.
Around the country, yeah.
There, you know, we've got low unemployment numbers now, but there's an anxiety. Too many people can't afford to get an education. Do you need a college education now? How do we begin to talk about technical training? And quite frankly, we need a lot more plumbers and electricians than we do lawyers. So all of these kinds of issues Michigan talks about. We talk about agriculture, talk about food. How do you get workers for the farmers and the small businesses? And Michigan has all of those issues. And every issue that somebody cares about, people should be able to talk to somebody who might be president of the United States.
Yeah. I also want to go specifically back to 2016, which you brought up earlier and talk about specifically what happened here. So in the primary, and to refresh the listeners' memory, the two major candidates in the Democratic primary that year were Hillary Clinton, who was a senator from New York, and Bernie Sanders, who's a senator from Vermont. And it was a pretty close contest for some time. Bernie Sanders won the primary here in Michigan. He didn't win overwhelmingly. It was pretty close, but he did get more delegates than Clinton did. And at the time, I think the part of the narrative was about the kind of problem that Hillary Clinton was having connecting with certain populations here in the state of Michigan. Fast forward to that October, to that November, when she is the nominee facing Donald Trump, and you were telling me about those problems that she was having connecting. You were seeing it in the district that that you live in, or that you were living in at that point. And it had a lot to do, in fact, with voters who are of Arab descent who live here in Michigan. We have the largest population of those Americans in the country. And it strikes me that in retrospect, if that had been evident earlier in the primary process, in other words, if Michigan had had a more prominent spot on the calendar in 2016, again, these issues might have been debated more hotly. They might have been more publicly thought of. And it's a great example of what you're talking about, that if you don't do it early enough, if you don't include everybody early enough, you really don't know what's going on.
There were so many issues that were – I started to tell you in 2015 that Hillary Clinton had a problem. Nobody believed me, but she's my friend.
A specific problem in Michigan, right.
And the reason, quite frankly, that I heard it – I mean, I did begin to hear it in Dearborn. Bernie did very well in Dearborn. But I want to go to 2015 when I remember the picnic. It was Local 900's annual picnic. And I know those guys and women well. And some of those guys walked up to me. And I hadn't picked a candidate, wasn't doing anything. And said to me, "Debbie, we love you, but we don't love your girl." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And they told me there was no way they're going to be able to vote for her a year early. And it was because of trade. And I kept telling the Democratic Party that our workers had seen their jobs shipped overseas. They were tired of seeing them shipped overseas, and nobody cared. And it's when we began, and Donald Trump understood it. He understood that fear and that anxiety of the working people.
Said
by the way,
repeal NAFTA,
didn't do
right?
A lot, but he understood and came in here months later, months, and said, "I'm going to repeal NAFTA. I'm not going to let your jobs be sent overseas." And when I'm intense, I was intense screaming at people, and people didn't hear me. People didn't go into union halls. I live in union halls. I make sure, COVID changed it a little, but now that we're getting back, I want to be in those union halls. I want to see everybody. And those union halls, by the way, reflect the diversity of this state. Sure. You see people of all different backgrounds, men and women, and people of all different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, and they tell me the truth.
Yeah.
And if you want to know the truth, you keep your mouth shut and you listen to what people are saying to you.
Yeah. When we come back, we are going to switch guests, but stay on the same topic. Jamal Simmons, a former communications chief for Vice President Kamala Harris, also a native Detroiter, is going to join us to talk about how all this fits into more of a national picture. Jamal has worked in Democratic politics all over the country for a really long time. Stay where you are. We're coming right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET, Detroit's public radio station. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. I want to change the tenor of the conversation a bit here and welcome Jamal Simmons to the show. He is a former communications director for Vice President Kamala Harris. He is a CNN political commentator and for a time was chief of staff for former Congresswoman Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, who served Detroit in Washington for many years. He is a Detroit native, but also a real powerhouse inside the Democratic Party, and somebody who has thought an awful lot about the way the party relates to and champions voices of non-white people and voters. Jamal, great to have you here on Created Equal.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me, Stephen.
So I want to start here. I want to talk about this new order of primaries and caucuses that are that we're dealing with in 2024. And I know that the impetus behind this, at least part of the impetus behind this, was to get more non-white voices earlier into the presidential process. I just want to get your reaction to the fact that we finally are making progress in that direction.
You know, this was a very big deal. As you know, for decades, Iowa and New Hampshire kind of ran the table on the first two voting contests, Iowa's a caucus and New Hampshire as a primary. They were the first two voting contests in the Democratic Party primary. I think what we've seen over time, though, is that particularly those states have had they've had limited success in choosing what would be a successful Democratic nominee, right? So except for the two big standout cases, right, which were Jimmy Carter won Iowa in 1976, mm-hmm. which was a long time mm-hmm. ago, and then Barack Obama won Iowa, obviously, in 2008, which catapulted him to the front of the Democratic pack. So except for those two cases, Iowa really hasn't picked a Democratic president. So the idea was, let's get, I think for the party's perspective, let's get states in the mix where there are the diversity of the country at stake, but also the diversity of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has changed a lot.
Yeah. So this year, of course, inside the Democratic Party, we're not going to be able to see quite how effective this might be because, you know, there's a sitting president who is a Democrat and he doesn't have much of a challenge in the primary process. But I guess game this out for 2028, for instance, when almost certainly it will be a wide open field in the Democratic primary. How different would the process look than what we're used to?
One of the things that made Iowa and New Hampshire special, and I will admit, I was a fan of them. I'm fine with the changes, and the changes make a lot of sense. But the mm-hmm. But one of the things that made Iowa and New Hampshire special is that, one, they were small, particularly New Hampshire is a very small place. It also doesn't cost a lot of money to advertise in those states, right?
Right.
So if you are an up-and-coming candidate trying to make your way, you can spend a fairly reasonable amount of money in Iowa and New Hampshire and be able to get your way through. So South Carolina is meant to replicate that. It's a little bit of a smaller state. It's less expensive. It's not a big major media market. It's not like going to Boston or going to, you know, L.A. or New York or even Atlanta, frankly. But when they get to Atlanta, obviously when they get to Georgia, that's going to matter. So as the thing about the presidential contest is it's kind of like the playoffs, although I don't want to rub salt in the wound. I'm still recovering from my Lions loss.
Yeah, that's not a good word around here right now.
Yes, me too. But every round gets tougher. And so in the beginning, you want to give a chance for everybody to participate and people who are not favored to have a shot at showing their mettle. And then you got to keep raising money, keep raising your name ID, keep campaigning hard. And so I think that's what's going to happen. South Carolina will go first. Nevada will go second on February 6th, which takes you out to Las Vegas, which is where most of the population is in Nevada. They're all in Clark County, which is basically yeah. Las Vegas. And then Georgia, which is different because Georgia, what we all think of Atlanta, which is where I went to school, the rest of the state is out there. A lot of voters, Democratic voters, in the rest of that state. So there are about six or seven media markets in Georgia for people to campaign in. And then obviously Michigan in February 27th, which we know is something like I think 65% of the population lives in the Detroit media market. So you've got a so it's gonna get more expensive. It's gonna get tougher. The issues are gonna get more complex, and candidates are gonna have to show what they're really made of.
Yeah. So inside the Democratic Party, I think we've learned a lot in the last couple of cycles about the power of African-American voters, the importance of African-American voters, both in terms of when they show up and when they don't. If you go back to 2016, for instance, 10,000 votes in Detroit didn't materialize. And that was really close to the margin that Donald Trump was able to win Michigan by. If you go to 2020 and look at the turnout in states like Georgia among African-American women, that turns the tide for Joe Biden. And it seems to me then that the primary process that we've been using has been disrespectful to that power, has been at best just ignoring how powerful that is, and that this new process makes more of a nod to the fact that African-American voters really do matter, especially on that side of the political ledger.
It's true. Listen, you can say what you want to say about Joe Biden. I know people have a lot of concerns right now and a lot of complaints right now. And for legitimately have arguments, right, about the president. One thing I think you cannot say is that this president has taken black voters seriously. Has not taken black voters seriously. He has taken black voters seriously. He picked a black woman to be vice president. He picked a black woman to be on the Supreme Court for the first time in history. So those are two history-making choices. He moved states with significant amount of African-Americans in them, South Carolina, Georgia, Michigan, into the process. Nevada has a significant amount of Latinos and frankly also has a lot of black voters. And for those of us who don't know, a lot of them are from Detroit, from Michigan. <Right. laughs> You go to there's a big Michigan.
They're just
Detroit
tired
picnic.
Of the winter.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I got relatives who are out there. You go out there, there's a big Detroit, Michigan picnic that happens every year, every summer in Vegas. So anyway, there's a so he's moved, you know, African-American voters to the forefront. So there are from that perspective and a personnel perspective, and appointed a lot of women judges, and a lot of them have been black women judges, not just in the Supreme Court, but down the ballot. Yep. Down the docket. So I think the president has taken African-American voters seriously, and he's trying to pay attention to that vote and wants future Democrats to be able to pay attention to that vote also. It's not just about his election. It's going to be about the elections that happen in 28 and 32. Yeah. And let's just keep in mind, I know a lot of people want to play the 28 presidential primary game. We haven't even gotten through the 24 game yet. And if we think back in history, at this point in the process, Barack Obama hadn't even been elected to the United States Senate yet. He was still state senator. So the idea that he would be president, you know, four and a half years later was something nobody had thought of. There are a lot of politics, as my dad likes to say. There are a lot of politics between now and 2028.
Yeah, yeah. I also want to talk about the Republican side of the ledger and I guess talk a little about what these changes mean to them. For instance, South Carolina is also moved up on their side. Again, that's not as much about black voters on the Republican side, because African Americans tend not to vote in large numbers for Republicans. But this idea of broadening the number of voices that are up front also seems to matter to the GOP.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, in the Republican primary politics, South Carolina has really often been the decider of who gets to be the nominee in their party. It's because it's kind of a raw, rough and tumble, tough, conservative environment. And the people there, they're not moderates. This isn't New Hampshire, right? This isn't or Massachusetts, where Ed Brooke, you know, the African American senator, was the first, you know, was there for a long time, African American Republican. This isn't that kind of a process. It's a tougher process. And so, if a Republican can make their way through South Carolina, usually that means they're headed to the nomination. It's a confirming process. We'll see if that works out this year with Nikki Haley, who is the former governor of South Carolina, versus former President Donald Trump.
Yeah. When we talk about the reform that we've had in the primary process and moving states around, moving states up, moving other states back, one of the things that comes to my mind is why we don't mix the states, I guess, more intentionally. So, for instance, maybe the first primary day could be Michigan and Alabama and Utah and Maryland, for instance. I mean, that's just a grab bag of different states. But this idea that maybe each primary could give us a real glimpse of what voters in lots of different places and of lots of different backgrounds think of the field. Why wouldn't that be a better way to think of this? And if it were, how do we get the parties to do it?
Well, here's what's tougher, and I've been in a lot of campaigns. There are real logistical problems when you start adding multiple states on the same day. And so,
because of the distance and geography?
The distance and geography, but also the cost. You know, you got to put two separate staffs in each place. You got to spend money on two separate kinds of ads. You might have to have two different kinds of substance to the ads, right? So you're in one state that's more rural, you're talking about rural issues. In a state that's more urban, you're talking about urban issues. So you've got to create, from the very beginning, a much more complex campaign when you have the least amount of resources for many of these candidates. And so what you want, if you want a process where you're not just going to pick the big boy or the big girl in the process, right? Like somebody who comes in, Hillary Clinton in 2008, right? She was the de facto Democratic nominee. Everybody thought she was going to win. She was going to be the one who took it out. And then Barack Obama shows up with John Edwards. There's kind of a mix of things that are happening. And Barack Obama goes just county to county, door to door, you know, event to event in Iowa. And a lot of those Iowa voters, who are very similar to the people in Southern Illinois, a lot of those Iowa voters say, you know what? I might take a chance on this guy. And it works. If it was a primary that was more complex at the same time, he would have had to be in multiple states at the same time, which might have hurt his ability to compete in any one particular place.
Yeah. Let's talk specifically about Michigan and the new role that we're going to play. We're going in February this cycle, which is great for us. What do you see as the challenges for the Democratic Party and its likely nominee connecting with people in this state? I mean, there's a lot of talk about disaffection with the Arab American population, for instance, some possible tensions with labor, which is a big part of the voting population here, and of course a huge interest group that is generally aligned with the Democratic Party. When you think about this year and the mission, I guess, for Joe Biden, who seems to be the likely nominee, of course, what are the hurdles they got to clear?
Well, one big hurdle just got resolved recently, which is the United Auto Workers president, Sean Fain, endorsed President Biden. That was the last major union not to endorse the president. So I think from the president's side, they see that as a big plus. Now, obviously, there's a lot of convincing to do.
I mean, it's one thing to get the endorsement. It's another thing to get the members to cast that ballot, right?
That's right. Like Ricky Ricardo used to say, Lucy, you got some splaining to do. and I think the president's going to have to come to Michigan and do some splaining about his policies and making clear kind of what he's been up to on things like the economy and criminal justice reform. You know, they didn't get the universal student loan forgiveness package, but they've been forgiving a lot of student loans, billions of dollars of student loans. Actually, a buddy of mine I grew up in high school with just sent me a text a couple of weeks ago. He ended up getting a doctorate in education. And he went to Finney High School, and he got a doctorate in education. He got two kids, and so they just forgave over $100,000 of student loans. for him. And so it literally is changing his life. His entire economic life has been built around paying these student loans and obviously paying for his family. So this is going to be a major impact for a lot of people around the country who've seen some of that change. The war in the Middle East and Gaza and Israel is going to be a major conversation to have. And it's a complex, multi-tiered conversation, right? You're having it with Jewish Americans who feel completely, I think, justifiably assaulted by October 7th and what they felt happened October 7th. And then you're having it with Middle Eastern, Muslim, Palestinian Americans, three separate categories, because they're not all the same. You know, growing up in Michigan, I always tell people, you know a lot more about Middle East politics than in many other places. Like, I always challenge people to tell me what a Chaldean is. most of them don't know.
They can't define it.
Right, exactly. Well, you got a lot of opinions. You tell me what you know about the Middle East. But, you know, so you got folks who also feel justifiably, I think, assaulted by what's happened since October 7th and, you know, tens of thousands of people who, you know, who died in Gaza and the destruction that's happened there. So we've got to figure out, I think, as a country and you know, as a world, what's going to happen in the Middle East. And it's an incredibly complex situation. But the president's going to have to come in and have real conversations and talk about what's happening and then probably take some action internationally and explain to the country how he's making things different on the ground.
Yeah.
In that very small piece of real estate in the world where so many people feel so invested.
Yeah. So quickly, I'm going to ask you about the Republican side. We have often seen an anomaly, I guess, in Michigan in terms of Republican presidential primaries. Of course, George Wallace wins the primary here and not many other states. But John McCain in 2000, after Governor John Engler had said, look, this is going to be the firewall for George W. Bush, who was leading at that point, John McCain comes to Michigan and wins. Is there the possibility this year, I guess, for something unusual to happen in the Republican Party? I guess some of it depends on whether Nikki Haley is even still standing at that point, because she's taken a beating in some of the early contests. But does she have a better chance in Michigan than other places?
Stephen, let me just say this. Over the last 7 or 8 years, I feel like the unpredictable has been happening at a much faster
everywhere.
Clip than things that were never supposed to occur seem like they keep happening repeatedly, including Donald Trump ever getting elected president of the United States. And I always laugh and think, if you went back in time 50 years or so and told Stokely Carmichael or even Coleman Young, probably, you know, that one day there will be a black president with an African name from the south side of Chicago who will be universally heralded as one of the great presidents of our time by business and by liberals alike. And you'd think you'd have a white billionaire, a white male billionaire from New York who would follow him in office, who would be reviled by half the population of the country. I mean, you know, America's a tricky place. You never quite know how things are going to shake out.
Yeah.
So, I have given up the predictions after.
Yeah, I know, and I know this is not your bag, right? The Republican side of it. But,
no, but look.
But you're a Michigander.
But the reason why I say it is because I think anything can happen. You've got a nominee who is facing 91 criminal counts, right? He just got a fine of $83 million for sexual assault against a woman and then having, you know, defaming her. So I think, you know, who knows if he can pay it. We still don't even know whether or not he can pay it.
He's going to have to sell something. He's going to come up with that money.
Right. Yeah. It might be a couple somethings because we don't know how much debt he's in. Which is all, you know, was also kind of a new and different thing. In the old days, candidates had to release financial reports that kind of detailed what their financial lives were like. And Donald Trump just refused to do it.
He's just not doing it. Yeah.
So there are things. I mean, you know, they had the Republican National Convention at the White House. I always remember that. When I was at the White House, I would have these ethics briefings. They tell you about, you know, you can't have lunch with somebody for more than $20 and not more than $50 in a year. There are all these sort of rules. I one time had to write a check to somebody, sent a couple T-shirts and some coffee mugs to my staff as a thank you present, and we had to write a check to them. You know. as because it was above the gift ban.
You can't take it for free.
Right. And I kept saying, but they had the Republican convention on the lawn.
Well, that was during the pandemic. You gotta get a little bit of a pass.
No, you get no pass. No. You get no pass. You can't do anything political like that in the White House. Are you kidding? It's never happened in the entire history of the country. So things do keep happening. So I say that to all that to just say, if Nikki Haley sticks around, there is no telling what could happen with Donald Trump, because we just don't know. We just don't know what may happen. It's all so completely brand new territory. And not to mention, you know, people look at Joe Biden's age. He's 81 years old. But Donald Trump is 78, 79. So they're not that far apart. So anything could happen.
Yeah. All right. Jamal Simmons, CNN political commentator, former communications director for Vice President Kamala Harris, and, of course, most importantly, native Detroiter. Always great to talk with you. Thanks for being here with us on Created Equal.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Stephen.
That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org, and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.